Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Gloucester Writer Center. Very happy to have Mitch Manning and James Stotts here tonight. Gabe Barboza is going to come up and kick this off. Yeah, that's what they told me. You're going to come up and say a few words about Mitch.
Mitch Manning, poet, public reader. That could be, he could be thumbing a Colette in the Park Street tea stop. You know where that is? On the bench, paperback. It could be December, below freezing, and he's down there with Colette, our country Colette, reading The Vagabond. He'll meet you in the park, on the bench. People are going to pass you by and ask, well, what is this? What do you have? What are you all up to with this city of water that he has, his poems? He'll come outside. What are you up to? All right, there he is. That's what he's up to.
Gabe's right. I spent a lot of time in the subway. I spent a lot of time underground. I spent a lot of time above ground on the bus. That was where I wrote this book. It's called City of Water. It was when I lived in Chelsea. And I rode the bus from Chelsea to Haymarket every day to go to work. And it's a pretty tripped out ride over there from Route 1 for all you Gloucester folks that go down into the city. It's always gnarly. It's always heavy duty. And it's pretty much grinding, soul-crushing traffic. But I sat there and started writing this book on 1/20/19, really, sort of the Carnage in America Day. And I started thinking about sort of, I don't know, all these kind of openings and vacuums in my own heart and in the country's heart, and really started thinking about, I don't know, kind of where we are. I'm grateful to read with my friend James Stotts. James has a brilliant new book, Elgin Pelicans. He's a really fine poet. All his poems come to him through the atmosphere, through his brain. He doesn't do a lot of writing. He does a lot of poem writing in his head. So he's a real dear, dear person. I'm excited you guys get to hear him read. I have a lot of poems. I told Dave and Gabe that I have this new problem where I have so many poems I don't even know what to read anymore. So I'm going to start with someone else. Grace Paley is a great poet and organizer and activist. And I work at the Joyner Center down in Boston, at UMass Boston. It was started by Kevin Bowen. And he was a Vietnam War veteran who was a poet and a scholar. He collected Sid Corman's archive. He's a great guy. And he edited this collection called Grace Paley Reader, which if you don't have it, you should definitely get it. And this poem's called In the Bus. And it's about a story that's in here about a woman that hands a baby to her on a crowded bus. Somewhere between Greenfield and Holyoke, snow became rain, and a child passed through me. As a person moved through mist, as the moon moves through a dense cloud at night, as though I were a cloud or mist, a child passed through me. On the highway that lies across miles of stubble and tobacco barns, our bus speeding, disordered, the slanty rain, and a girl with no name, naked, wearing the last nakedness of childhood, breathed in me once, no, two breaths. Beside, she whispered, hey you, begin again. Again? Again. Again. You'll see. It's easy. Begin again. Long ago. This first poem is for the poet Fanny Howe. And she wrote a book called The Needle's Eye Passing Through Youth. And it's a book about, she said she was writing a book about mercy. And I thought she was writing poems. And I would see Fanny. I studied at UMass Boston and she was there for a while and knew Fanny at readings and we'd get coffee. And she'd always say, I'm writing this book on mercy. And then the book came out and it was nonfiction and it was about St. Francis and the Boston Marathon bomber, Johar Tsarnaev. And it's this really wild book and it's about youth and innocence. And so the poem's sort of after this image of St. Francis. And it comes from the poem's called Bare Life. And it comes from a line by the Italian writer Agamben. And he writes about a soldier who's stripped of citizenship for committing a crime. And he lives in his own country, stateless. It's called Bare Life. I open myself to surveillance, like Francis, standing at the woodline without clothes. The villagers embarrassed for the marks and scars they gave him. At the edge of the meadow, a procession of robed in wreath, barefoot mendicants, hair of laurels, a single tambourine, a fecund hope grown in northeast gardens. uninterrupted bird song, a prayer wall for lost causes. Someone scrawled a name so small, we thought it an accident. Did prayer stop the wall, the killing, the heart from falling to the floor? I tie myself to something at the bus stop so I don't sink through the street into the river. My heart beats, unsure of its own path forward, a wire errantly crossed. To save or be saved on the 751. Tomorrow the sun will disappear and the light through the window will be flat and empty, depthless. I stand in silence, unsure where living or lying begins or ends. Whose clothes will I put on? Which persona will I wear? This energy of bells ringing across the eaves and gutters asks, who is our warlord of night? When will we go to battle? Courtrooms are instruments of imbalance. Who has trust in a system that defies them? Survival isn't happiness. Bare life is enough, say adjudicators of the state. And all is fair beneath wig and robe, unless you're naked and your head is shorn. I never memorized poems, but they started like living inside me when I started reading from this book, and it was really funky. This poem's called Venus in Kyoto. I wrote some of the poems outside the bus, but the bus was really like a sort of container where I sort of started thinking about the spirit the way like Grace Paley thinks about that spirit on the bus and how we sort of all exist kind of in this one space. So Venus in Kyoto. I wrote this when I went back to Japan where I grew up. The heavenly body awakens, dressed in a kimono of sweat. I sit in temple gardens until I'm no longer there. Midsummer lotus bloom, the pond gurgles itself, knowing a garden is as beautiful as a caretaker. Taizo, continuously practicing hidden virtue without expecting anything in return. At Wonder Cafe, I saw the line of men crossing the street. Four apostles of Liverpool. What if Yoko was right? Take the sound of the stone aging. I count backwards the seasons, see the incumbent moon, golden Venus in relief. I solve two koans in sleep. Dream of friends singing until their voices are hoarse. Alpha Station, FM, Kyoto, you're loud and clear, buddy. I practice meditation at the urinal. Ants climb the tiles, cicadas hiss. After the floods, the heat. After the bomb, the fall. I look down for a moment and everything's past. The tsunami wasn't like the great wave of Hokusai, but swell of tide rise all at once. Swallowing the hills, the schools. Only they didn't gather there on the playground. Only the earth didn't shift itself. Everything was just fine, fine, fine. I'm tongue-tied at the thought of it. The language of evaporation, desire on the tatami mat. I miss the meditation class to dream. What's a house and what's a temple? Do good things come out of the earth? I turn back to soil, grow lotus from a muddy pot. This is the season of pond bloom, luxurious bamboo floors, twitching before sleep.
Hey. Hey.
How many poets are in the room?
Well,
what does that mean?
Yeah. How many people write poetry? How many people write poetry?
Sometimes.
Sometimes?
Photographs.
I love it.
Listen to music.
Good, good, good. I've been thinking about, like, well, what is, like, poetry and how does it work and where does it come from? And I've just been thinking about, like, I don't know, all these, like, kind of spaces that open between us. I'm teaching, like, this literature and visual art class, and I'm trying to get kids to, like, think about poetry and think about art for the first time. And it's really fun because it's trying to kind of reorient the kids back into their own experience, because a lot of their lives seem to be like trying to gauge what others want from them. And they have like this expectation of what's to happen, and I'm trying to be like, go back. What do you care about?
What grade?
This is freshman in college. Cool. And this girl wrote this review of this art show we went to on campus, and the first sentence she wrote is like, I wasn't sure what to think when I went into the show. I felt misplaced, and I like was so happy. It was like I circled the word. I was like, yes, begin there. Like, start with misplacement. Like, where are you? I thought that was really rad. So that's like sort of, I don't know why to say that, but that's like a lot of what the poems try to do, is try to figure out like where, how do I place, I don't know, the self or something here in this world. So I'll read some of the long poems. City of Water. The morning bus pulls up an insect. I board into its jaws, bound backwards towards the city. Bridge shadow over the river. Cars on the freeway echolocate from sealed bubbles. Spring arrives at the power plant. School buses empty out of the stockyard. Rainfall, 2 weeks now. Harbor fog, boat chains, pylons. A sea lion barks out of season. The floods return tomorrow, and I'm still late for work. At the honeydew in Lynn, I melt my mask, eat alone in Antonio's, study the universal pawn symbol, snort my own mucus back in, eat the black pills to save my life. Late winter beach light, the anonymity of coats, sibling surf and neoprene, bus over the bridge, Narcan, menthols, iced coffee. Can spring be more resplendent? Wall of forsythia, dogwoods weeping, a barrier from the world. The eclipse bored a hole through me. Three times I saw the sun circle the moon before I got off the floor. All day I crawl around in this skin husk, hang nothing from my walls. I'm bare bulb, cold water, chew my fists, eat my heart, wonder how to chum myself out into deathless sea. Cry softly, lonely one, Roy sings over the bridge as car exhaust drips down to the mystic. I drift out the windows and back in again. Fall asleep sitting up. It's like losing an echo. Rust out on the pier, a time apart from sun and daylife. I wrote five prayers across a nickel, spit them out into foam. Phantoms rise above the bridge as bodies fall through the awnings of cafes. Two energies in opposition. Life force and death force, rising and falling, yin gone, the heavy yang sinks towards dead weight. The sky snaps open above a wire. I lie in the bower of a graveyard with my shirt off. Poplar and tombstones, elegies to all who are past but linger. Mothers and founders, children missing and gone, a primeval sound of longing. People remember the movement of my bike, riding with no hands, gliding across another sensibility, the air a lathe, the wind a shield, tears streaming backwards, running the length of my face and neck. Dawn rise from the airport, tide a waving hand, a dredge plumbs the harbor, combs the depths of the channel. This is the monolith, rhododendron, color bloom, pink and wine red in the gray skies of April. John returns to Schuyler every few months. Something about close reading. I write around the margins in hope of remembering all this. I'm just going to skip around to the end. Riding backwards through the tunnel, your ghost in the passenger seat. All the sand between us. A swatch of cloud above the folding ocean. I wait for the mountain to move, the repeated days of standing, fall into spinning mirrors. A line of light runs through your silhouette, two hands joined in friction or pressed to a higher spiritual order. How many lanes run across this mystic? I dream of revolving staircases, sand through the fingers. We stare at the same ocean, skip messages across the water, two ponds, five time zones. To be understood seems a curse, unsolvable. Expectations crash down like a geodesic collapse. The weight we carry, the bus that won't come. My ceaseless scroll of defeats. It has a coda. I used to see the same guy stop every day, and he lived in the affordable senior housing, and he would stand against the mailbox, and he would be bent in hell. He had this huge beard, and I called him Zeus, and he would stand there and just smoke cigarillos every day, all day long. He never really talked to anyone, and I don't know what his deal was, but he was beautiful. Coda. City of water, which threatens us. Three doors to dream through, each a path to the familiar. Sun's winter arc halfway through. Errant wipers, sputtering wet salt. No city except people. Sumner, Tobin, Zakum, broken Zeus hunched over the mailbox. Cigarillos and coffee in the short circuit of early morning. Cold air seeps through the door. Jung's shadow chasing me, the intangible conflict that makes war real. Thanks, guys. This is a new poem I wrote for Fred Hampton, who was killed 50 years ago in December of 1969. He was 21 years old, and they screened a film at the MFA called Who Killed Fred Hampton? He was a Black Panther. And you know, what's pretty clear is that he was shot in his bed by the Chicago police and was hunted by the FBI. And all he really did was like organize community, like daycare and lunch programs for kids. And, you know, that was a lot of the work that he did. And I don't think he was as strident or as political, you know, in terms of his speeches as other people. And he was murdered for it. And this is called Nightline for Fred Hampton. And I saw this film, it's a really great film called Who Killed Fred Hampton, you should watch it. And I read a lot of poems about watching movies, and it's like a good place for language. It was called Nightline for Fred Hampton. It will etch itself into the photograph. The men seeing the ocean for the first time. The beach grass. Incandescent sun somewhere above. The continuous, precise rolling of film and waves. The panthers at the podium, waiting for crescendo. Thunder is deepening at the horizon, gathering together its many voices. I'm bobbing out here, following the long arm of the dial through the windshield. I've cast off and have no structure of my own to return to. Read the elegies. Follow the impulse, Melissa says. Regurgitate, coagulate. It's all I can do. Try and stop the endless whirring of machine sounds. They've come to nest in my attic, sirens of their calls, a ceaseless storm that's only finished when it's run through me, come up through the throat, enunciated, gargled out. I'm calling, but I don't have a band to listen. The cantata is building, the machines clattering. I'm alone in a room beneath a giant radio, hesitating and dreaming, slipping between things, spaces. I received a message from a different source. We'd never spoken, and now I know how we're aging in front of the windows. Our angular eyelids the raven's feet that grow like cracked glass. Certitude is lying in its own blood in the apartment, shirtless, the smell and sound of munitions, the fucking cops, 13 of them, dark muses of someone else's mind. You cannot kill Fred, even if he's dead. Sheep are skinned for wool boots, but the 21-year-old revolutionaries are cosmic now. Constellations across the Chicago night sky. When December turns its dark gaze toward solstice, we hear the sirens and remember the raids, armaments of liberation. The people, the people, the power, the people. I want to read a poem for Garrett, but I don't know which one to read. You know, I think one of the best parts about the Writers' Center, I've seen many great people like sit in the seat, and it's always been like very joyful for me to come here, but it's really the community that the Writers' Center creates, and that's what I'm really grateful for, what Amanda does and what everyone who helps organize here. It's like really just one of the greatest community writing, art, creative spaces, and it's really refreshing, because we were talking about how Boston can be a really kind of fractured city in some ways, and it doesn't always feel like it has a kind of sense of cohesion and art. With Gloucester and the North Shore really, really does. I'll just read a couple more. Besides, the laws of the peacock are stark, each eye a letter, an alphabet, each book a world, each book into the next. Cycle, sequence, chronology. Memorize le fleur de mal before rejecting it entirely. A passage is a pilgrim, a paragraph a function. Each fortress of words opens the doors a micrometer more. For each book destroyed, someone will write it in another time or place. This is the symptom of eternity. Endlessness, conduits of desire. I create a library out of everything I reject, an architecture of dismissal. I turn the watch with boxing gloves, repeat the same cycles of longing. Mail is delivered today and tomorrow, but the man on the corner reminds everyone his prowess for beatdowns at daylight. Returns each morning to the same dirty corner. Don't call him crazy. He knows. All right, I'll end with this poem. This poem's called Beyond. And it's, did anybody know the artist Paul Laffoley? Garrett, I think, knew him. He was sort of Reich inspired. And he was a visionary artist. He had a practice in an art space in Boston called the Boston Visionary Cell. And there's this new book at the restaurant that James works. They have it on display there. And he did this really wild geometric graphic stuff. And he was influenced by astrology and occult stuff. And he was a kind of Harvard dropout and really brilliant. And so this is for Paul Laffoley in the Boston Visionary Cell. And, you know, it's probably inspired by Garrett too, because I spent a lot of time in Garrett's living room and absorbed a lot of his teachings. It's called Beyond. And it starts with a kind of, I don't know, a little quote from Nanoi Sapkaki, who was a Gary Snyder friend. He was a kind of wandering madman in Japan, poet, beatnik. And he has this line that says, what is it? It's kind of a riff at the beginning. I'll just read it. Beyond. Smash the mirror. Live forever. Sculpt myself into an existence. Comb my hair carefully behind my ear. Separation of scents and steps along the sidewalk. To be hidden from the sun by the peak of someone else's dream. Who is the greatest visionary? Who is most enlightened? Pigeons in the park, narrow, bulbous beaks, eating garbage on the ground. This is a simple realization. Food and famine, Misery slumped over luggage in Union Square. 4,000 more dreams dashed this month. Plaques memorialize every cop, not the starved and screaming, poor or lost. Veneer of respectability. The civilized world is full of only noise, not even to be harvested. Integral to the machinery of war. Unforgivable apologism. I'm searching for all the not answers before I can dig up my own like a dirt-covered stone. The magus climbs the steps of the library licking his empty pen cap. The auditor wearing his Masonic ring buys chocolate for the holidays. Can art change lives, stop the bombs? Picasso declared a degenerate, driving wax molds to the foundry at night during the war to bronze his casts, a rugged man holding a lamb 6 feet tall, molded in a day. The exigency to create despite circumstance and companion. Giacometti's screaming skull, spindly statue, someone is pasting the faces of strangers to billboards. These aren't my leaders, it says, languagelessly. Tacit understanding, speak out of both sides of the mouth, read an embarrassing poem. Be a field of passion with no container, no mold, no images to frame on the wall, only a cycle of language rotating around itself, an endless rolling of chariot wheels. If one has expectations for the world, everything is a disappointment. The desire of recognition, to look and be seen by someone, to replace the inattention of another, a mother, for attention of one, or some, or greedily, all. To look and be seen by the one, a one, anyone, to be seen but not through, to stand out like exotic plumage, but to crave inscrutability, invisibility, to be neither seen nor saw, nothing there, not a one.
You want to say words about James?
Thank you, guys. You can buy my book in the back, but you should also buy this one right there.
I'm going to trade you for one.
Oh, okay. I'm going to trade you for one for sure. That's like the best. I can't wait until I can be where I can put my face on my own album. I dig that. Look at all these Hanuman books. Man, this place is rich. Seriously. Speaking of rich, the next poet I would like to introduce is someone who is steeped in a world so rich and full of images and language and poetry. And I asked James when he wrote his first poem. And he said, because a lot of people are like, oh, I wrote in high school, or I wrote a poem here or whatever. And James is like, I've always been writing poems. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, it's like at the holidays when you're a kid, 6 years old, I'd write a poem. And he'd like recite a poem. And James is really, truly a brilliant poet, translator of Russian, of Brodsky, of Mandelstam, of Svetaeva, of poets I can't even pronounce. He's been to the American Academy in Rome. He was a guest there as a visiting poet. He has traveled the world, translated Russian. This is his second book called Elgin Pelicans on a Boston press, Pen and Anvil Press. And he is one of our great local poets. So please welcome James Stocks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Thanks.
It's really great to be in Gloucester, to get out of the city. We had a beautiful day. And it's really nice to be welcomed into this community. It seems fantastic. Most of my poems don't have titles, so I'll try and give enough pause that I don't confuse anybody. You blessed me like the superliminal logic of a smoke tree in bloom. Color no animal in nature can imitate, unless it's that first hour of the dawn as it sets upon a cloud. You lay down with me with a scent on your lips, part my own. No telling what it would give you if I had anything other than my body. This is a marathon poem. I wasn't in town that weekend. I had gotten out of Boston to go to Lake Champlain with a buddy. And when I got back, I realized that I had 40, 50 calls from friends and relatives wondering if I was okay. But this is a poem about that. Mid-April, passing Manchester, the cherries. There's one more thing that I'll say about it, and then I'll start over again. There's an old English poem, the Riddle poem. I don't know if people know it, but I'll read it real quick. It's, I gave my love a cherry that had no stone. I gave my love a chicken that had no bone. I gave my love a child that had no crying. A cherry when it's blooming has no stone. A chicken when it's pipping has no bone. A child when it's sleeping has no crying. Mid-April, passing Manchester. The cherries have no stone. Washing their virgin wings in the river wind. Not nearly as material as those bald Merrimack pylons. I am the immaculate receipt of bestial capital and care. Barely 30, but already I can feel the worms between my legs, the black mold fastened to my bones. And in my memory, it was the same hour as the cherries, the finish line burst into flower. This is a poem where I'm a hill, called So Far. Here I am, the hill, looking over the pond. I'd like to come down like the dawn, like a handsome man in a pair of obscenely comfortable shoes with an easy way of walking, or like a swan, and fuck every pretty little thing that passes by. But I have no mouth, no shoes to speak of, no breast or wing or bone, no car. Nothing but a handful of sweet-smelling dust to toss at the wind. No earthly idea how I'm supposed to drown. If I had a cat, I'd name him Zeffs, and we would listen all night long to the golf course owl's perfect two ellipses. If I were in the ground, my rot would make a sound. If I were in the stars, we'd make a new speech with the commiserable reaches only we knew of space. I could keep it together if Jack came back. So my father was a railroad engineer for the Santa Fe. He was born in Kansas, and he was a bowler. But the Santa Fe took him to Oklahoma, and that's where he met my mother. She was a waitress at a bowling alley, and that's where my oldest sister was born. And then the job took him to Colorado, which is where the other four of us kids were born, and then to Albuquerque. And when we were growing up, he was always out of town. He was on projects all over the Midwest and the Southwest. And he would be in Montana or Nebraska or the Dakotas or California or Kansas or Oklahoma. And we didn't see him that often. And so about 20 years ago, he found out that he had some mineral rights to a farm that his grandparents had owned in Oklahoma. And the way it works there, and I don't know if it works the same way here, but is if you buy the farm, you get half the mineral rights, and the people who sell it, you get to keep half. So he had like a 64th of the farm's mineral rights as it had come down to him, but they started fracking. And so a lot of money started rolling in. He was getting checks for $40,000 or $50,000. He made like $200,000 in a year. And then it sort of dried up. And I'm sure he still gets some of it, but I never saw any of it, so I don't know exactly how much he gets. But I was going to read a couple poems about my father. And that will probably, what I said, will probably make sense of most of them. So, Lord, all I am is in my pockets. Pale green ghosts that I use to light my way home along wrong roads. Stars laundering my body. Morning storms through heaven like a golden battery. Lord, be a good dog, kneeling behind me. Let us walk and run each other until we're as long and lean as my father's fracking money. 5 a.m., my father on the front steps, nursing a camel to the bone, quietly waking his five wits. He leaves the house alone before the last cherry in the morning sky is crushed out in Apollo's thigh. That ancient routine, so like my own, I must be in his debt still after 20 years. And yet what can I know of this soft-spoken, fleet-footed man who barely left a shadow? Will I, so busy with so little done, leave any more impression? My father, slowly beaten down by rain and wind, saw a beaver yesterday dive into the flat, walking down by the water with his phone, near an old switchyard with a rusted vane. He called to say hi and where he was at. So I'm going to read a longer poem that I wrote for Joseph Brodsky over the course of about 12 years. But about a year ago, it was 2 years ago, I went with a friend, Melissa, to see in New York Baryshnikov Brodsky, which was the show where Baryshnikov was playing the part of his friend Brodsky through like interpretive movement and also reading the poems in Russian. And during some of the dances, like they would have like the super titles of the poems. And I don't usually do this, but I had like a plan for the poem because one of my favorite poems by Frank Bidart is Ulanova at 46 at Last Dances Before Camera Giselle. And in that poem, a young Frank Bidart, when he's a college kid at Harvard, like finds a film of Galina Ulanova as like way past her prime, but she was the premier Soviet ballerina. She was Stalin's favorite ballerina. Dancing the part of Giselle in the ballet. And it teaches him something about the fleetingness of art and the ghost that you move through in each movement. And it's a fantastic poem. And I remember when I was growing up, when I was a kid, like when they would do the PBS drives, they would have, a lot of times, I saw it more than once, Baryshnikov doing Giselle, doing the part of Lord Albrecht. And he's doing like the dance to death. So Albrecht falls in love with this peasant woman, Giselle, and when he's figured out, she kills herself in her despair, and he goes to her grave, and the female spirits of the graveyard come up and curse him to dance until the dawn, to dance to death. And in her pity, every time he's about to falter, she comes in and like fills in for the dance, and he survives the night. So I wanted to go see the show with Melissa and then I'd be ready to write a poem. But it was sort of like I was going to work and it all came out like it was like premature ejaculation. It just the poem came out really quick before it was supposed to, but this is that poem anyway. Pouring rain over I-93, bulwark cataract channeling the heavens over State 38, the switchyards and Sullivan Station. Iron waterfall I shelter under with the birds and buses and smoke and wait for work. I let the body learn its lines again, standing still in its stall. My dance every night is a vain counter-survey. The Caesars will always, eventually, find us out for what we are. I am Baryshnikov behind the bar doing Albrecht by the grave for the eye that never blinks and looks unblinking back and documents the days. Can I do this to myself, to death? Late after I lock the doors, my last camel's last breath is living out its afterlife on my lips. And the spoils of the storm say, there's an easier way. Reach down for the stars. Dive. And then this is the pilgrimage poem that I wrote for Joseph Brodsky. I have traveled to Arkhangelsk, where I went to internal exile, and I was in Innispolfin, which is one of the little islands north of the Aran Islands in Ireland, where he visited before he made his way to America. The reason I came to Boston was because of my love for Joseph Brodsky. And then this, and a couple friends in Venice, and we were going to visit the grave of Joseph Brodsky at the island of San Michele, like the cemetery for unbelievers. This is Eclectics for Jill. 1. Birds dragging themselves from the battle of daybreak, like spilt blood. Blue flies barely woken after winter, singing, signifying nothing. We ripped off your rings and song, like children. Sold off the memory of countless flights as you erased the sky. Now you limp and mutter, life in the dissipated light. Or, I loved you. For a little while, like brushing across nettleweed. Then, after weeks of beer and cigarettes without a dream, forgot your face, replaced it with a girl's. I make a point to occupy your space. Would you have seen me in a crowd? I have seen you. Unless we walked into a room, alone. But you're no longer of the body, only of the blue. About a year ago, I remembered how the half was like the whole of you. How adumbrations in the dissipated light fade and then reform, taking on their own life. Watching fish pass like ghosts under the Hudson, Urania like a palimpsest, my illegible English over your once unintelligible babble. Is it your eyes or just the sky's flash green? I remember how I read you. Zavivato, Zavivato, Zavivato. 2. Notes of thin grease and wild flowers on the last breath of a Bactrian fag crushed in the gray snow. The tundra is teeming with porticos, and a Lethe frozen half the year holds fish boats and freighters in thrall, hides beds of sunken logs, buries archangel spawn to nurse all winter long on paper pulp. This is where they sent you to stand sentry on a gypsum wall, watching the white sea, meeting out convict songs with calloused heels. How did you survive it all? How did your gray eyes stay evergreen? The broken teeth you spit out in your dreams took root, brought forth lime saplings covered in seeds. When Anna died, doctors sewed her ghost into your thigh, and a fairy doctored your visa so you wouldn't have to wait in line. 3. Ironic, Maria's resemblance to Sandro's Venus and St. George's to hers. The same way girls' faces harden into medallions. The same way love turned Joseph's face into a girl's. 4. Seaward over the hill, I hear the bittern's asinine call on the inlet way to St. Gregory. Overhead, our restless fathers and all the late beasts of making roll across the sky, sans foulée. Joseph in the crowd of stars, senseless now to the bitter tramontane below, blowing in like camel smoke off the harbor, the pus and ichor of the clouds. Melissa, bent in a Euterpean pose, courting the nor'easter. Lyosha, losing your soul to the ultralingua of the episode 7-all. Sunny, monsoon counselor, shunned by Venus and Kama. And Derek, already a glimmer in your eye, nectar in your veins. Crushed cigarettes follow me like breadcrumbs to the corner store. Birds and wind drown out your song. Sure sign of a coming storm. 5. This century then was less than dawn's first sentiment of day. Melissa lent me your coat. Anna has a little girl. And this is the way it goes. You follow me now, and my following you. Piloting by flags of blue graffitied wool, of Innisfofen efforts, fleeced by rain, or crouched on the ice, a mile out on the sea in April, naked before the spinning distaffs of gray archangels. Gangrened escapade haunting the white horse, or catamountain, goat song, coat of arms. Sometimes the lathered skullfuckers scudding the Charles seem familiar. Wherever I go looking for you, you come with me. Like the hard-up honeybees in Rome, trying with their dying breaths to win the ancient reckoning home. I'll end with a couple of poems from my ex-wife, and then a couple breakup poems since the divorce. My neck, my heart, my haunches. I'm almost certain I was built to drag dead geese from the marsh grasses. But here I am, in what passes for a man's body, living no more than an animal existence, until I see, far out past the fog and phragmites and the formless frenzy of biting flies harassing the brackish waters, another creature, twice as beautiful as me. And I know she knows my name and gives me the pleasure sometimes of taking what little I have to give away. This one is called Defeat. Maria is my shield, telling my stories for me. I rest her on my back to sleep. She's so sweet. And when she's gone, my defense against predators is to make my body poisonous meat. I am, you are, the world is, too much conjugably withholding. And then, I found out that she was leaving me while we were in Venice in January, and by the time I got back, she was already not in the house. And while we were in Venice, I got this book of, I got Marco Polo's Voyages, and I was reading it at a bar, and him explaining all the, like, the strange traditions and customs of these Eastern peoples in the wild lands that he was going through. And I thought maybe that sort of made sense of, I got married in Russia, my wife is Russian, from Nizhny Novgorod. And so I thought maybe this explains, like, these people that, I, like, it had gone right over my head, and I didn't know what happened to me. So I borrowed a lot of the language of Marco Polo for this poem. We had a sort of salamander industry, but no beast can live in fire. I should tell you, the people of Gorky have a particular custom, and I'll describe it to you. Whenever a woman's husband leaves on a journey of more than 20 days, she takes a new husband as soon as he sets off. And the men wherever they go take new wives as well. I was only gone 10 days.
Cool.
And then the last poem actually has a Russian title. Called Pisk v Domike. Sweetest thing, Pisk v Domike. Sweetest thing she ever said. And she said it so many times in bed. Sometimes I even fell asleep inside her. And Pisk v Domike just means that, like the penis is like in its little home where it belongs. She used to say it in the hotel. Thank you all very much for having me come.